Nizim de Souza.
Yeah.
So they're still in limbo?
Oh, he was. Well, one second. They were on opposite sides. I thought D'Souza was also devout Christian.
That's right. So they had him. That's what they had.
Oh, it was two against one?
Actually, it was three against three. Uh-huh. They had Sam Hara. They I guess they flew them down to Mexico, mm-hmm. and the introduction was all in Spanish. They spoke English. And there was the late Chris Hitchens, Sam Harris, and Daniel Dennett against D'Souza, Charlie Mateo, and Robert Wright. He didn't really fit. He admitted that he wasn't really there to defend religion. He wanted to place himself somewhere in the middle. But those were the six guys.
Interesting.
That's exactly the way it is.
There's a sort of a consensus in philosophy now that I call it moral ethical realism, that you don't have to be religious to know what's right and what's wrong. And Shmuley Patel got up there, just like this idiot William Lane Craig, who wrote lectures on the internet, and said, well, if you don't believe in God, then moral and ethics is just like your preference for flavors of ice cream. There's no objective basis to it.
Right. I hear you. Okay.
Start.
That goes back to Dostoevsky. Said, without God, all things are permitted.
We waited for you.
Okay. I understand. Okay, everybody. Upon request, or I'm not forcing it, obviously, people asked me to kind of switch topics to a totally new mitzvah. And what was suggested or recommended is that we study Divergence Minhagim in Klal Yisrael, but as a text to start off that study, we would look at Maseches Sofrim. And Maseches Sofrim, even though it has the word Maseches, which normally means a Talmudic tractate, it is not a Maseches of the Gemara. It belongs to a genre of other Masechtos that are called Masechtos Ketanos, the minor or the small tractates. They are printed, they happen to be printed in back of the Gemara. They are not part of the Babylonian Talmud. They date from the time of the Gaonim. So if we just approximate that the Talmud was finished at some time in the 7th century, so this dates from the 8th or the 9th century, around 100 or 200 years later. And some of them are Babylonian compilations, representing the Minhagim of Babel. Others are Eretz Yisrael compilations, representing the Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael. Maseches Sofrim largely represents the Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael. Now this is very, very interesting, because remember that at this time the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael was very small, very beleaguered, very persecuted. They were losing their influence to the Gaonim of Babel and to the Babylonian Talmud and the like. And Maseches Sofrim is almost like a last-ditch effort to preserve some of the ancient Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael. And as a result, there are many Minhagim in Maseches Sofrim that are actually extinct because they, this was their last attempt to codify them. At the same time, however, Maseches Sofrim itself was edited by the Babylonian Gaonim, so in a sense they changed some things, or even if they left the Eretz Yisrael Minhagim in, they put in the corrective, the better practice of Babel and the like. So Maseches Sofrim does contain many, many quotations from the Gemara. So it'll quote Rav Yochanan, Reish Lakish. It will quote, but it is not of the Gemara. It is, in other words, the Gemara would never quote Maseches Sofrim. It's the other way around. Maseches Sofrim is quoting the Bavli, the Yerushalmi, and the like, because it dates from a later date.
Just give us a little historical background, if you know. About how many Jews were all together in Yerushalmi in the 18th, 19th century, and where were they?
Well, they were mainly located in the north, meaning to say, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, as you know, Jews were not even allowed to live in Yerushalayim for several hundred years, and even though there were Jews living in the Eretz Yehuda, most of them were up north. So, for example, even the Talmud Yerushalmi, which dates from the 5th century, was actually a product of Tveria. The Sanhedrin, which had been hanging around for a few decades after the Bar Kokhba revolt, was also up north. So there were virtually no Jews in the Yerushalayim area. Yeah, they went to 10 different places. They were in Sipore and in Tveria for a while, Usha, different places, Shafaram, you know, different places up there. How many there were, I'm not really sure. I don't have the exact numbers. But religiously, people don't realize the Churban Beis HaMikdash, which the year 70, 69, 70, did not initiate anti-religious legislation, meaning essentially Titus destroyed the temple because the Jews were politically revolting against him, against the desire of the Chachamim. So Titus was Machru of the Bias, destroyed Yerushalayim, took many Jews as slaves, but other than punishing a political rebellion, Jews were allowed to learn Torah, they could do mitzvot, there was not anti-religious persecution. The anti-religious persecution of the Romans was the aftermath of Bar Kokhba, that in the year, 135 was the crushing of the Bar Kokhba revolt in Beitar. And at that point, Hadrian Adrianus, the emperor at the time, was no longer going to be Mr. Nice Guy, so to speak. And at that point, all of the gezeros against Bris Mila, against Torah Barabim, all of that was there. In fact, that's why Rabbi Akiva died, either because of his participation in the Bar Kokhba revolt, in terms of encouraging it, or in terms of his religious teaching of Torah Barabim and the like. So basically, halachic learning in Eretz Yisrael, certainly after the Chasima of the Yerushalmi, was very, very low. That's why the primary product that was produced are piyutim, religious poetry, midrashim may have been produced, very little halachic work, and that in turn gave chizuk to the gaonim who were spreading halachic directives and the like. But what happened was, in spite of this, there was still aliyah. People were still coming from Bavel to live in Eretz Yisrael because they wanted Kedushas HaAretz, but they were bringing their Babylonian minhagim with them. And as a result, the small indigenous population that was still there, they found their minhagim getting castigated and criticized and undermined, not only in Bavel and the other countries that turned to Bavel, but even within Eretz Yisrael. It was very common during this tekufa for there to be, now we have so many shuls, we're used to it already, but to have two batei kinesiot in a typical town in the Galil. One would be the Minhagei Bavel, and one would be the Minhagei Eretz Yisrael, and generally speaking, the Babylonian synagogues grew larger at the expense of the Eretz Yisrael synagogues. So a sefer like Maseches Sofrim was an attempt with Babylonian editing to preserve some of the ancestral Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael. Now what I mentioned, number one, and again, there are many. For some reason, the Rishayim always talk about seven Masechtos Ketanos. On the other hand, if you look in the back of Avodah Zarah, you count at least 13. So it's not really clear what they're counting and what they're not counting as Masechtos Ketanos. But of all of the Masechtos Ketanos, Maseches Sofrim is the biggest one. It is fairly big. But the Girsa in Maseches Sofrim is extremely corrupt. Like all Eretz Yisrael documents, whether it's the Yerushalmi, the Tosefta, and the like, and as a result, sometimes the text is virtually indecipherable without the Hagos that we have, and the Vilna Gaon was Magia, but of course Vilna Gaon lived in the 1700s, right? So his Hagos, we can't say for sure that was the original text, but the Vilna Gaon was Magia Maseches Sofrim probably 1,000 times. There are probably 1,000 emendations that he made. And some of the emendations are just cosmetic. They're not a big deal. You add a vav or whatever it is. But many of the emendations are absolutely substantive, in which a sentence is changed. Now, there's an old story about all of these Hagos, whether it's the Hagos of the Bach, let's say, the Bach is, has many, the Rav Yoel Shirkus has many Hagos in the Gemara. The Gra has many Hagos in the Gemara. The question, Hagos is when, the Gra is the Vilna Gaon. Hagos is when you change the text. You indicate that instead of this word or this phrase, it ought to be this phrase. There's always a question, what is the basis? Are we talking about what you would call a modern scientific kind of manuscript comparison, where you're looking at manuscripts and you're deciding which manuscript seems to be more accurate? Or are we simply talking about changes based on logic, based on, well, this doesn't look right, so we're going to change the text. Now, for a regular person to do that would be extremely dangerous and irresponsible. I don't like what the Gemara says, so I'll just change the word usher to mutter, whatever it would be. But, you know, the Vilna Gaon, someone like the Bach, you know, who had mastered all of the Torah, perhaps they could be magia with Svara. We're not really sure. There's a person, he must be an older man by now, but he's a phenomenally learned, he's a Talmud Chacham and an academic. This is, I think Yaakov Spiegel is his name. Have you heard of him? He's a professor at Bar Ilan for many, many years. And he wrote a whole book, fascinating sefer, a whole book on the nature of Hagos, the nature of the industry of people writing emendations. So he has like a whole chapter of what was the methodology of the Bach and what was the methodology of the Gra. And really, it's so good because when you open up a Gemara, you'll often see little squiggly notes at the bottom of a page. You know, somebody put, like, who did those? Who put them in? You know, he identifies like every single strata of all of these marginalia that are all over the place. Like, where did they come from? Huh? Yeah, the Gemara itself does. Yeah, well, that's correct. The Gemara itself does it. Yeah, you're right. Now, I just want to point out that this history of changing texts because it's a lot more logical to have something else, this was something that many Rishonim did. In fact, Rashi himself, we don't realize how many texts Rashi changed simply because Rashi's changes became incorporated in the printed Gemaras, most of the time. Some of the time not, Rashi will, you know, but most of the time. So we don't realize Rashi was a major, major Girsa changer. But again, we don't know Rashi's methodology either. Was it manuscripts? Was it Svara? And this was followed in a great way by, you know, Rashi, as you know, had no sons. Rashi had daughters, and although the sons-in-law were Talmidei Chachamim, but mainly the grandchildren are more famous than the sons. And Rashi's, the two most famous grandchildren are brothers, older brother and younger brother. The older brother is Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. And the younger brother, who became even more renowned, is Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, known as Rabbeinu Tam. This goes back to the 12th century. And he was called Rabbeinu Tam because Yaakov ish Tam, Yoshev Ohalim. So as a matter of kavod, he was given the appellation Tam, the perfect one, Rav Yaakov ben Meir.
We have a copy of the Gemara before Rashi's emendations.
Well, I'll get to that. We do, as a matter of fact. Now, the Rashbam changed also many girsas following Rashi, and Rabbeinu Tam gave his older brother a strong musar. He says, "You don't dare change a book if you don't understand what a girsa is, or if you propose an alternative text. Propose it as an alternative, but leave the original text intact, because perhaps someone else will see that your reasoning is wrong." And in fact, it is recorded that Rabbeinu Tam, who really was considered to be the greatest halachic authority in the world at his time, in fact, there are those that say he was greater than the Rambam, Rabbeinu Tam supposedly issued an excommunication on anyone who incorporates a textual change in the text itself. So the Rishonim were of different feelings about this, and then we have Achronim like the Bach and like the Gra, and if this is true for the Talmud Bavli, which was relatively better preserved, when it comes to the Yerushalmi and the Masechtas Ketanas like Sofrim, Girsa changes are legion, over and over and over again, and you know, I can't validate, you know, who's right and who's wrong, what is the original text and the like. There is only one critical edition of Maseches Sofrim that dates from 1937. This was a Rav Michael Higer, I think he was a professor somewhere, H-I-G-G-E-R, or Hey Yud Gimel Resh, and he is the only one, and people are saying that a lot of his conclusions as to what is the definitive text are actually also erroneous in light of more modern manuscript techniques. So we do have a lot of problems in getting a text. And as I say, when it's just a matter of cosmetics, you know, it doesn't change the meaning of something. Yeah, this word, he, who, spelling, you know, that's not such a big deal. But when it impacts on halacha, it is a big deal, because Maseches Sofrim is read to say one way, then it's changed to say something else. You're actually changing what the halachic determination is. So that's going to be a problem. So what I'm going to do, simply because of the absence of an alternative, is I will be primarily following the Vilna Gaon's Hagos, but when there are some significant deviations, I'll try to point it out. Okay, so this is an interesting point. To what extent is Maseches Sofrim a source of halacha? So here we have a very, very interesting divergence between the Ashkenazi poskim and the Sephardi poskim. Now, as you know, the Sephardi poskim, represented in the early stages by the Rif and by the Rambam, and then later, much later, by Rav Yosef Karo, and this is pre-Kabbalah, by the way, pre the spread of Kabbalah, kind of the rationalistic Sephardi poskim. Then we have the Ashkenazic poskim, represented by Rashi, and then Rabbeinu Tam, and then eventually the Marshal, and then eventually the Ramah. Right? These are spanning hundreds and hundreds of years. So there was a very, very big difference. According to conventional wisdom, I think I mentioned it last week, and again, this conventional wisdom is questioned, but this is a conventional wisdom. He says the Sephardic traditions, the Sephardic Jews, their origin was Bavel. Their origin was Bavel, and they spread. And as a result, they remain very, very rooted in the Babylonian Talmud. And in fact, keep in mind that the famous rule in Halacha, that when there's a machlokas between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, you go like the Bavli, and that's a rule, a fundamental rule in Halacha, that was created by the Gaonim of Bavel. And in a sense, they were basically saying, you must listen to us because we're telling you that we're more authoritative. I mean, that's what it was. So as a result, the Maseches Ketanos that record many Mahalchim from the Yerushalmi and the Eretz Yisrael Minhag tended not to be followed by the Sephardic Poskim. So the Sephardic Poskim give very, very little credence to Maseches Sofrim, except to the extent that it's simply duplicating what the Babylonian Talmud says, you know, in which case it's not Maseches Sofrim that is the source of the authority, it's the Gemara itself. On the other hand, the Minhagim of Ashkenaz, it is said, actually derive in part from the old Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael, through Italy and the like, Eretz Yisrael to Italy and then to Europe. Now, that means Ashkenazim are schizophrenic, because here is the problem. The problem is that even Ashkenazim eventually accepted the principle that the Talmud Bavli is the authoritative source of halacha. That principle is accepted by all kehilas, including Ashkenazim. But because there were minhagim of Ashkenaz that are even earlier, this is quite amazing, there are minhagim that were nishtaresh in Ashkenazic communities before the 7th century. They were Jews in the Rhineland and the like. As a result, they had pre-Talmudic traditions going back to the Eretz Yisrael times. And as a result, although formalistically Talmud Bavli is given pride of place, Lamaisa, the Minhagim of Maseches Sofrim, do have a certain resonance and a certain continuity. Now we're going to see, though, that because of the Girsas, it's hard to know exactly what those Minhagim are, and we're going to see that Minhagim that developed can be based on Maseches Sofrim, but may not be exactly what it was. In other words, they've been modified and changed over the years. So Bekitzer, I would say, as a generalization, that although the Sephardic Gedolim were in possession of some text of Maseches Sofrim, and they used it, they learned it, but generally speaking, a common sentence would be, if it argues with our Gemara meaning the Babylonian Talmud, we do not give it any attention, as opposed to Rabbeinu Tam, let's say, who said that the Minhag Ashkenaz is Kolel, Midrashim, and Maseches Sofrim, and the like. But again, it's schizophrenic, because sometimes Rabbeinu Tam himself will say, well, we don't listen to Maseches Sofrim because it's contradicting the Gemara. Other times he will say, well, our Minhag is Maseches Sofrim, etc., right? So it's schizophrenic. It's like saying, we will follow the Gemara Except when we don't, but you know, it doesn't tell you exactly. But all I can say is that a lot of this is connected to the age of the minhagim. Meaning to say, if we were debating about a new practice based on Masechet Sofrim, Rabbeinu Tam would say we're not going to do it if it's against the Gemara. But there were minhagim. We don't realize how old the communities were. You know, the Babylonian Talmud has a date, right? Has a date. And before that date, there were still Jewish communities in the diaspora that had minhagim and had customs coming from sources that are older than the even, not just the Gaonim in Bavel, but older than the Amoraim in Bavel. Now, particularly in Inyanim of Tefillah, Kriyas HaTorah, Sidurei Beit Knesset, right? These were old minhagim, wherever Jews were. So as a result, it was a question of how to assimilate the Gemara to the existing structures, and you know that's where you see it. You see a difference. Rabbeinu Tam quotes Masechet Sofrim. Yeah, sure. In many Tosfosim in Shas, you will often see Masechet Sofrim is quoted, or at least paraphrased, or the like. A lot of times, for example, if you learn the end of Masechet Megillah, it gives you a list of haftoras. And a lot of the Haftaras are not the ones we say. And Rabbeinu Tam will say, we are Someich on Masechet Sofrim. Right? Things like that. But these are generalizations. In fact, the whole idea that Sfardim are based on Bavel and Ashkenazim are based on Eretz Yisrael, that is a conventional wisdom. But again, some have said it's an oversimplification, and it's not necessarily true, and there were mixtures of both. And of course, even in Eretz Yisrael, remember, as I said, there was Babylonian congregations and Eretz Yisrael congregations, and they would fight in Cairo, in Fustet. Fustet was the old neighborhood of Cairo. The Rambam was the Rav, right? People, besides everything else, the Rambam had a part-time Rabbanus as well. He was the Rav in Fustet. And there was a rival shul in Mitzrayim, in Cairo, that kept the Minhagei Eretz Yisrael. This was a reversal. These were Yerida. People that come from Eretz Yisrael, and they were keeping their Eretz Yisrael Minhagim, and the Rambam tried to close them down. The Rambam said, you know, it is absolutely not proper. These are not Minhagim that are according to Halacha anymore. And that's notwithstanding the fact that the Rambam actually, of all the Rishonim, he was not wedded to the idea that the Babylonian Talmud was final. He sometimes did paskin like the Yerushalmi. Sometimes. But nonetheless, he felt that the Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael were no good. And a common line that the Gaonim used, I don't want to make it sound like a propaganda thing, but a common line that they used when they would try to discredit the Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael is they would call these Minhagim Minhagei Shemad. Shemad. In other words, they were saying, given the fact that the religious persecution was so strong, and there had to be all sorts of stratagems not to be caught doing mitzvot, and the chinuch was weak, and the Jewish education was weak because of the great persecution, as a result, people had an ignorance of the Torah, and therefore they didn't really understand halachic nuances, and therefore the minhagim should not be followed, because they represent minhagim of ignorance, born out of the deep persecution of the Byzantines against. Actually, you'll find that this is a common refrain, minhagei shmad, and therefore, I mean, sometimes they would call it minhagei shtus, that's a little harsher. Minhagei shtus are customs of foolishness, but when they were charitable, they would just say, well, we don't blame them for what they're doing, but they're minhagei shmad, and therefore, and it was almost like a stereotypical line that when the Gaonim didn't like a certain minhag. Now again, I don't mean to say the Gaonim just arbitrarily didn't like minhagim. In other words, when they saw minhagim that were contradicting the Talmud Bavli, they would deem them to be non-halachic and call them minhagei shmad and the like. So Masechet Sofrim, as I say, on one level, it's not actually the last-ditch effort. There was a later effort in another sefer, but is one of the attempts to preserve in amber some of the ancient minhagim. But as I say, it itself underwent Babylonian revision in some ways. And also, I have to say too that not everything in Masechet Sofrim is revolutionary. As I say, a great deal is actually lifted from the Babylonian Talmud and there, or the Mishnah, and therefore it's not controversial. So a lot of stuff is not controversial. Some stuff is. We don't know the Gersa. You know, that's another problem. Now, another problem that we have with all Eretz Yisrael texts, Bichlal, for some reason, maybe it's because we're just not used to it, the writing style of all documents that emerge from Eretz Yisrael seems to be singularly obscure. The Yushalmi's language is obscure. It's Lashon Kitzara, Miod. Midrashim, as we know, generally Midrashim tend to be obscure. The Masechtos Ketanos, which are a product of Eretz Yisrael, tend to be obscure. Whether that itself was a result of persecution or there was a particular writing style that was more intelligible than it would be for us today, often the texts are very, very obscure. And number one, not only are the Gersas corrected, but also when Parshanut is offered to a text. So there's a tendency among many Meforshim to try to reconcile the text to the Halacha as codified in the Bavli. In fact, this is a common technique that commentaries use in the Yerushalmi to say, well, we're not sure what the Yerushalmi means, but since the Bavli says this, so we'll just twist the Yerushalmi so it'll say the same thing as the Bavli. But the argument has been that maybe that's not a correct approach, because maybe it's the other way around. One should recognize that the Yerushalmi might be expressing very, very different minhagim. In fact, in this connection, there's a great, great, an amazing story. You know, the Yerushalmi, as you know, doesn't have really classical Meforshim like Rashi. We only have Meforshim from the Achronim. The Rishonim, with some exceptions, did not write comprehensive commentaries on the Yerushalmi. But there was a Rav in Russia, Krasowski, I don't remember his name, but he was like the last Rav in Moscow during Stalinist era. And, you know, he was being watched by the KGB. He really couldn't do anything. He couldn't teach, he couldn't have Talmidim. But he wrote a massive commentary on the whole Yerushalmi. An amazing, amazing commentary.
Published.
Well, I'll tell you the story. But he wasn't allowed to publish it. You weren't allowed to publish Jewish books in Russia, nor could he give it to somebody to take out for him. It could not be taken away. So there was a fellow who ran, this is during the years of the Soviet Union, in the 50s and 60s, this old rabbi was still alive, and there was a Rabbi Brownstein, Harry Brownstein, who was involved in very, very early outreach to the Jews in the Soviet Union. And he smuggled out the Ksav Yad of this commentary in the Yerushalmi, like, you know, a page at a time. He'd put it in his shirt, or he'd put it, you know, he'd hide it in all sorts of places. And over the years, because he would come several times a year to help people, but over the years, he smuggled out the whole Ksav Yad. And this, the Yerushalmi was published on Seder Zeraim. Now, I'm not sure why it took so long, why they haven't published it on the other things yet. This is already 30 years that the Zeraim has been out. But this author, this Rav was a tremendous, in fact, Moshe Feinstein wrote a tremendous haskama. He said that this was like a person who was learning Yom HaVelayla in the middle of Stalinist Russia. And he was able to learn the Yerushalmi, the Bavli. But this person writes in his Hakdama two very interesting points he makes about Yerushalmi and these types of Limudim. He said like this, he said, the only reason why we find Yerushalmi so difficult is because we're used to the Bavli, and since the Yerushalmi is such a difficult, different style, so it becomes difficult. He said, if you were to start your learning with the Yerushalmi, you would find the Yerushalmi easier. Because he says intrinsically the Yerushalmi is a simpler approach. It's less pulpilistic and the like. So he said, this idea of the legendary difficulty of Yerushalmi, he says, is only a product because we're habituated to the Bavli. That's one point he made. The other point he made is, this is exactly the point I just said, that people make a mistake when they try to artificially reconcile the Bavli and the Yerushalmi instead of recognizing they are two different traditions, and therefore the Yerushalmi should be interpreted in terms of what is most plausible in terms of its own text, as opposed to forcing it to be the same as the Bavli. So that's an interesting point. It is true, again, Masechet Sofrim is along the lines of Yerushalmi, so that's why I'm talking about Yerushalmi a little bit. It is true that the Yerushalmi is much less popal. You know, in the Bavli, you'll have question, answer, question, answer, question, answer, proofs, refutations. The Yerushalmi will ask one question and give one answer and then go on. A sugya in the Yerushalmi is much, much shorter. than the Bavli. But it's not as well developed. So there's actually a thought of Rav Kook. Rav Kook basically says that the length and complexity of the Bavli, which actually makes it easier for us because the arguments are more fully developed, is a consequence of Golos. Because he says like this, he says, in Golos, truth is arrived at only by process of elimination. It's very, very interesting because we don't intuitively grasp truth, but we consider a bunch of alternatives and we kind of eliminate them. And when you eliminate everything that's not right, so you're left with the final answer. So if you think about the way a sugya of Gemara operates in the Bavli, it is often a process of elimination type of idea. Somebody throws out, there's a contradiction. Somebody throws out a hypothesis. The hypothesis is refuted, so then there's another answer. In other words, you gotta prove every single thing because you're getting to truth by process of elimination. In the Yushalvi, Rav Kook says, it is more in the nature of prophecy and intuition in which you kind of, because of the holiness of Eretz Yisrael, you simply grasp the truth without having to go through a developmental process. Mm-hmm. So he says that the halachic aspect in Eretz Yisrael was connected to it was not prophecy technically, but it was connected to the notion of prophetic revelation. Huh?
Right.
Say again. No, that's correct. That's correct. Yes, okay. Now you say prophecy was given to fools. Okay, but that's what that was. Rav Kook. You know, I had mentioned a fellow, Rav David Ben Chaim, an interesting fellow. If you've seen Machon Shiloh, he calls his website Torah for those who dare to think. This is the name of his website, and. Yeah, he's a British guy, but you know, whatever, he Hebraized his name and everything else. David, I think it was David Mandel was his name, now it's David Ben Chaim. And his whole goal is to bring back the Yushalmi, bring back Maseches Sofrim, bring back the old, extinct Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael, including the Siddur, a whole Nusar. It's not Ashkenaz and it's not Sfarad. It is called Siddur Eretz Yisrael. And it's very interesting. Number one, it's a lot shorter. It's a relatively short service. And there are people that, follow him. Besides, you know, abolishing kidney is doing other things like that. But he wants to change the nusach of the Siddur. He says, we live in Eretz Yisrael. We should go back to the authentic old minhagim of Eretz Yisrael and not have the burden of the gola that is still upon us. So all of what I'm saying is going to be a problem in Maseches Sofrim because sometimes the girsa in Maseches Sofrim is changed to make it correspond to the Bavli, when in fact the original girsa was Bedavka not following the Bavli, right? So that's going to be a problem in how far do you go to make things consistent, or is the more honest approach to recognize that there are differences here. Now, in terms of Rashi, just to go back, you would ask, do we have a manuscript that predated the Hagaos of Rashi? The answer is we do. In the Vatican, yeah, we have more than one, but the only complete manuscript of Ksav Yad of the Talmud Bavli is called the Munich manuscript. Now I don't know where it is. Is it here in Israel? It's called the Munich manuscript. It had been in Munich. I don't know. And in the 1890s, there was a Chashuva. Talmud Chacham was also a scholar, Rav Rafael Rabinovich, who meticulously went through this whole manuscript and he compared it to the standard Babylonian Talmud, and he wrote a sefer called Dikduke Sofrim. Dikduke Sofrim is a multi-volume a treatise of the entire Munich manuscript of the Babylonian Talmud with extensive Hagos annotations and the like, and then you can actually see, you know, what was changed, what was not changed. Now again, a lot of things are not matters of substance, but some things are. Rashi made major changes in the Talmud that became part of the printed text. The other person who did major changes that became part of the printed text was the Marshal. Rav Shlomo Luria did enormous amount of work in trying to standardize the text of the Babylonian Talmud. But unlike the Bach, who has many Hagos, but they never change the actual text, the Rashi and then the Marshal actually entered the, they actually were taken in by printers. And people were critical of that because they said, well, you know, if you're amending, you should note it as an emendation. But it wasn't their fault, it was the printer's fault. I mean, it was the printer's fault. The printers incorporated the changes, and they would boast about it. They say, we have new and improved Gemara because we've incorporated changes. But let me give you a totally unrelated example, though, how incorporating changes can sometimes be counterproductive. You know that throughout the Middle Ages, the Talmud was extremely censored by Christian censors. And a lot of times the censors were apostate Jews. They were Jews who knew how to read Hebrew, and they were employed. In fact, the Catholic Church issued a censorship manual of what expressions are supposed to be taken away. So one of, just to give you a crazy example, one of the expressions that the Catholic Church said must be removed is the phrase goy, because they knew that when Jews talked about the goyim, even today, it tended to be a derogatory. And that's why they put in Nochri, or even the word Akum, Oved Kochavim Mazalot, to emphasize pagan, not just a guy. But to show you how ignorant the censors were, we actually have manuscripts where the Pasuk says, Mi Ka'amcha Yisrael, Goy Echad Bioretz, they put, Mi Ka'amcha Yisrael, Nochri Echad Bioretz, because they saw Goy, the guy didn't know, says Goy, okay, you know, the guy just went through it, Goy, you know, you have to rest. Or even something like this. For some reason, the Catholic Church didn't even like the word Talmud. They didn't want the word Talmud to appear. So whenever the Gemara refers to Talmud, take it out. Now, sometimes Talmud is just a synonym for learning. For example, there's a famous Talmudic expression, Sichas Chulin Shel Talmidei Chachamim, the casual conversation of Talmidei Chachamim, Tzuricha Talmud, is something you can learn from. So in many Gemaras it says Tzuricha Limud, which means the same thing, but they just took out the word, they just took out the word Talmud, no, etc. So, here's the thing. So the Catholic Church did censor the Babylonian Talmuds very extensively, but they didn't realize that, the main censorship was anything having to do with Jesus, anything to do with Yashka. There were many passages in the Talmud bearing on Yeshu, although people argue which Yeshu it was, but, you know, and these were taken out, right? Anything to do with Jesus, take out. Anything to do with Christianity, take out. But they didn't realize the following, that there was a book that contained many passages of the Talmud that wasn't the Talmud itself, and that was the Sefer Ein Yaakov. What is the Sefer Ein Yaakov? The Sefer Ein Yaakov was written in the, was compiled in the 16th century by Rav Yaakov Ibn Chaviv in Tzfat, and this is a collection of all of the Agadata in the Gemara. Now the Catholic Church was not aware of this, what this Ein Yaakov thing was. They thought it was just a book. So they didn't bother to change it. As a result, even after the censorship of the Babylonian Talmud, many authentic nuschos were preserved in the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov actually had the original text because the Ein Yaakov was not subject to censorship. So what happened to us in the 19th century, the world famous Dafus, right, the Vilna Press, Ha'achim v'Halmana Ram, the Ram Press that was run by the widow and the brothers, because her, you know, her husband was a printer, and when he died, the widow inherited it. So all the famous, the most classic of the Jewish printer, Halmana v'Achim Ram. So they hired, in fact, they were a really important employer, because many poor Kollel people or rabbis were employed as proofreaders, as magiim, as people who would go over documents and the like. So they gave a great parnassah to many, many great Talmidei Chachamim and many poor younger rabbis as well. So they were putting out new and improved editions of everything. Shulchan Aruch and Tor and Rambam and Yerushalmi and of course Bavli, the Vilna Shas, is still the standard. So they put out a new Ein Yaakov. And they boast in their introduction that we have assiduously corrected the corrupt Ein Yaakovs to correspond to the Babylonian Talmud. Now their argument was, after all, the Ein Yaakov is taken from the Talmud, So presumably the Talmud is the authentic text. But they didn't realize it's the other way around. The Talmud was subject to censorship, and the Ein Yaakov wasn't. So the Talmud should have been corrected, huh? Well, I don't know. You know, people
but
make.
How did the Ein Yaakov know what was authentic? Since it was written so much later, would only know what the Catholics had done.
You're right. But the truth of the matter is, I want to point out that the censored passages were never totally. Well, I don't know. Maybe we lost some things irretrievably, but you know, the censored passages were preserved in different manuscripts. In fact, that's why today we have Chesronos Hashas. We have books that publish. Some Gemaras put them in, some don't. I don't think our scroll puts them in, I'm not sure. But Steinsaltz does. We do have access. We're able to recapture them and the like. In fact, one very interesting repository, an early repository, was put together by an Anglican cleric, Hereford. Travis Hereford, who published a book in the 1920s called Christianity in the Talmud and the Medrash. And what he did was, he gathered together all of the censored passages. He reproduced them in the original Hebrew and Aramaic. Then he translated it and annotated it. So we do have those passages. And keep in mind, too, that because there were manuscripts from Sephardic countries that did not undergo the same censorship, so you were able to kind of reconstruct it from there as well. So you know those are so the whole history of manuscripts and corrections and what's the original, what's not the original, all of that is you know you can go back and forth, and you sometimes make a mistake in which you think the authentic one should be the source of correcting the inauthentic, when in fact the inauthentic is more authentic. And you have to know which way to move in terms of that. So Masechta Sofer, as they say, is one of those tractates where you face this problem a lot. So just because there's no other choice, I'm going to primarily rely on the Vilna Gaon, but I'll try to point out the other things. Now, Masechta Sofer really deals with a wide variety of themes. Sofer, of course, means a scribe, a sofer. And the first few chapters, which I'm not going to start there, I'm going to start in the middle. The first few chapters actually deal with writing a Sefer Torah. It deals literally with what a sofer does, writing a Sefer Torah. And although that is interesting, and hopefully we'll get to it, it's not particularly controversial because the bulk of the rules that Maseches Soferim says are simply the rules that are recorded in the Mishnah and the Gemara. So they're not so different, meaning the Eretz Yisrael Sefer Torah was not written fundamentally differently than the Sefer Torah in Bavel. In that part of Maseches Soferim, there was a lot of discussion about what you call the orthographical features of the Masoretic text. In other words, which words, it's really a manual, you know, which words are chaser, which words are malay, which words are kri, you read them even though they don't appear, which are kasiv, they're written and you don't read them, right? So there's a lot of lists, and the lists are important. Some of it agrees with our halacha, some of it doesn't agree with halacha, right? But that part I'm not going to do right now. But again, these are the dots, all of the unusual writing, whether it's kri, and which is not kasiv, or kasiv that's not kri, whether it's chaser or malay, whether it's nekudos, right? We know that there are dots over certain words that have a great significance. In fact, this week's parsha has a dot, has a series of dots, when it mentions the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni. So it says a person is tamei or bederech rechoka, far away. He is given the chance to bring the Korban Pesach a month later. So there are a bunch of dots, there are nekudot in the Sefer Torah over the word derech rechoka. So Chazal have a drasha that even if you're not really that far away, you're just 6 hours away, that's enough to be patur, right? So it gives you a list of nekudot, right? All of these they called orthographical peculiarities. Large letters, small letters, like Hashem Echad is a large, right? Shema, big ayin, Echad, big dalet, aid, witness, Bereshit, a big bays, in Vayikra, small aleph, right? So it gives you many, many lists of those type of peculiarities. So it is a major source, because the truth is the Gemara doesn't give you these lists, right? So now again, though, I have to say that is also a peculiarity of Eretz Yisrael, because one of the things that was very big in Eretz Yisrael, when it wasn't so much halachic learning, was the origin of the Balei Mesorah. The Balei Mesorah in Tveria, they kept the accurate records of the biblical text, the peculiarities of the letters, and the like, and they were the repository. Particularly, there was one family that was especially talented and considered authoritative in this. This was the Ben Usher family. Aaron Ben Usher was a Baal Mesorah in Tveria, and the Rambam writes that the Ben Usher Sifrei Torah are the most authoritative reconstruction of the Sefer Torah, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. This was the Ben Usher Codex. It's still somewhat different than our own Sifrei Torah. There are some differences, and there's a bit of a controversy about this. So Maseches Sofrim, in recording all of these listings, is really following the pattern of the Balei Mesorah in Eretz Yisrael. So that's like the first. So the first part of Maseches Sofrim is literally the rules regarding writing a Sefer Torah and the peculiarities of the letters and that you have. Now the next part of it talks about the minhagim of Kriyas HaTorah, the public reading of the Torah. And the third part, which is intermingled, is about tefillah and chagim and different holidays, right? So that's the part that we're going to focus on, because that's the most pertinent to our own practices. Kriyas HaTorah, chagim, tefillah, and the like. So I'm going to start with Perek Yud, right? Perek Yud of Maseches Sofrim. And this begins, again, I don't think I'm going to read everything inside, but I just want to, it just begins the idea that Moshe Rabbeinu, again, and this is actually from the Gemara, so this is not a chiddush in Maseches Sofrim, that Moshe Rabbeinu enacted that there be a public reading of the Torah on Shabbos, on Yom Tov, on Rosh Chodesh, and on Cholo Shel Moed. I think this might be a little bit of a chiddush. If I remember the Gemara says, No. The Gemara says Moshe Rabbeinu was Mesakeh in Kriyas HaTorah on Shabbos and Yom Tov. In Maseches Sofrim, it attributes Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed to Moshe Rabbeinu. Ezra was Mesakeh that there be Kriyas HaTorah on Monday and Thursday and Shabbos Mincha. Okay, so that's important. So in Kriyas HaTorah, according to all views, Kriyas HaTorah is a rabbinic law. It is not a Doraisa. Hashem did not command that we read the Torah, except perhaps for Parshas Zohar. And even that, it's not at all obvious that Parshas Zohar requires reading from a Sefer Torah. I have to verbally remember Amalek once a year, who says it has to be from a Sefer Torah, who says it has to be from a minyan. So it could even be, even that is drabanan in terms of reading it from a Sefer Torah. So Kriyas HaTorah is midrabanan, but it's an old drabanan, meaning the basic takana. See, Moshe Rabbeinu made rabbinic laws. Moshe Rabbeinu made a takana that we should hear the Torah every Shabbos, and Chol HaMoed, and Yom Tov, Rosh Chodesh. And this is the meaning of the pasuk, Vayedaber Moshe es Moedei Hashem el Bnei Yisrael. Moshe spoke about the holiday. So we think that means he just told them about the Yomim Tovim, but this is understood to mean he instructed that we should read about the Moedim, which includes Shabbos. Even though you might think, well, Moed only includes Yom Tov, but that's not Emes. Because Vayedaber Moshe es Moedei Yisrael is at the end of the Parsha of Moedim in Emor. And if you'll recall, Ela Moedei Hashem Mikroi Kodesh, these are the holidays, the first one that's mentioned is Shabbos. So Shabbos is also called a Moed. As we say, Kihu Yom Techila LeMikroi Kodesh. It is the first of the holy days. And therefore, that is a chiyuv of Kriyas HaTorah, that's a takana of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, by contrast, Ezra, much later, added Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos Mincha. Now, why did he add Monday and Thursday? So, he said the following, that a Jew should not go 3 days without hearing a public reading of the Torah. Because we find, when the Jews wandered for 3 days without water, they started complaining. So allegorically or homiletically, that's understood. Without the water of Torah, you lose the sense of meaning in your life and you complain against God. So as a result, we hear the Torah on Shabbos. So Sunday is 1 day break. We hear it on Monday. Then we have Tuesday, Wednesday, a 2 day break. We hear it on Thursday. Then Friday, right? So really, the truth is you never go more than 2 days. You don't go 3 days. You either go 1 day or 2 days without the Torah. So that's one reason. And why he picked Monday and Thursday was Monday and Thursday were market days for small villages that would come to the big cities. And a lot of the small villages either didn't have minyanim or they were ignorant. They couldn't do their own Torah reading. They would come to the big villages, come to the big cities to market their produce. So as a result, he was misaken a Kriyas HaTorah for the days that the populations would come. That is also why in the time of the Amutanoim and Amoraim, the Batei Din, the court sessions, courts were not open every day, but the Batei Din were open on Monday and Thursday, because that's when people were coming in anyway, so it was a convenient time to make the court. So that is why Kriyas HaTorah is on Sheni V'Chamishi. And why was he Misaken Shabbos Mincha? That's a different reason. The Gemara says, actually, the Maseches Sofrim doesn't give you the reason, but the Gemara says, Mishum Yoshvei Karanos. What are Yoshvei Karanos? People who sit idly in the marketplace just to schmooze. Shabbos afternoon was kind of a dead time. People would just hang around, like the teenagers hang around. And therefore the concept was, let's give them a shir, let's give them... See, Kriyas HaTorah has a different image than we have it. We look at Kriyas HaTorah as a davening thing. Kriyas HaTorah was not really a davening thing. Kriyas HaTorah was a learning thing. Essentially, it was a learning session. Remember, in the time of Chazal, there was a maturgaman who would translate the verse, and not only translate, but would augment it with midrashim. In fact, the Targum Yonasan, or pseudo Yonasan, is not literal like the Targum Onkelos, but there are many midrashim in the Targum Yonasan, and it has been speculated that this is like the transcripts of the maturgamin who would embellish with midrashim and interpretations. So Kriyas HaTorah is not part of prayer. Kriyas HaTorah is part of Talmud Torah. So essentially, to keep people off the street, a mandatory Shabbos afternoon shir was instituted in the Kriyas HaTorah. This is Yoshvei Mishum Yoshvei Karanos. That's why I have to admit that there was a Pesach Halacha I saw that I think didn't make sense based on this idea. What was the idea? The idea was... Yeah, this is what I saw, and it actually does not seem right to me. Let's say that you had 10 people, and the 10 people, each of them heard Kriyas HaTorah separately. They heard Kriyas, but they didn't daven yet. They got up late, they came to Shole, they heard Kriyas HaTorah, and now they form a new minyan where they're going to daven. So this posek said, since Kriyas HaTorah is an integral chelek of Tefillah B'Tzibur, so once they form a minyan to do their davening, they are mechuyev as part of that minyan to have a Kriyas HaTorah, even though each individual person had already heard the Kriyas HaTorah, but now they're mechuyev because a minyan that is davening is mechuyev in Kriyas HaTorah. That frankly, I don't remember who said it. It frankly doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because that's like saying that, you know, just like you got to say Kedusha, you got to do Kriyas HaTorah. Well, that's fine, but the question would be, if every yachid was yaitzei, as being part of it, they were part of its Sibur when they heard Kriyas HaTorah.
But this Sibur was.
Well, that must be the lumbus, that every Sibur becomes Nischayev in Kriyas HaTorah. On the other hand, I want to say Rav Chaim himself, the Hebrisker, Rav Chaim himself felt Kriyas HaTorah was a Chiyev on the Yachid, not on the Sibur, yeah.
So why do we have Kriyas HaTorah in Shacharis?
No, that goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. No. Remember, Moshe Rabbeinu was Misakein, but we have to read the Torah Shabbos morning, and Yom Tov morning, and Rosh Chodesh, and Chol HaMoed. That's Moshe Rabbeinu's Takana, because he felt that's what you do on Shabbos. On Shabbos, we read the Parsha. But the Mincha thing is an augmentation to prevent streetwalkers. In fact, you know, before Kriyas HaTorah, on Shabbos Mincha, we say a Pasuk, and Vani Sfilasi Lecha Hashem Eis Ratzon, may my prayer, this is from Tehillim, may my prayer come before Hashem at a time of grace, Elokim Barav Chastecha, Aneini B'Emes Yeshecha, right? With the abundance of your kindness, may you answer me with your salvation. Why do we bedafka say it then? Because the Medrash says that why did David say, Ani Tfilasi Lecha Hashem Eis Ratzon? Because David HaMelech said that unlike the Malchei Umos HaOlam, that are Yoshvei Karanos, they waste their time with frivolity. I come to study your Torah and to learn your Torah. And therefore, in the zechus of my devotion to your Torah, and not being Yoshvei Karanos, may you answer my prayer. So, the Torah brings that since the Kriyas HaTorah of Mincha is, so we shouldn't be Yoshvei Karanos, we invoke the same pasuk that David HaMelech invoked. Right? You remember this lesson from the Hadron, if you remember the Siyumim of the Masechta. We thank Hashem, Shesamta Chelkeinu Miyoshvei Beis HaMedrash, V'lo Samta Chelkeinu Miyoshvei Kiranos. Right? And that is actually the reason for the Kriyas HaTorah of Shabbos Mincha. Yeah.
Because if Kriyas HaTorah is Talmud Torah,
yep.
The women are Mechuyah, yep. Which means that they come late for davening, but they should do davening, not listen to the Sefer.
Yep.
So Kriyas HaTorah on the other hand is part of Tefillah,
yep.
Where women are Mechuyah, and they may have to listen to the Torah and try to fit their,
yep,
davening in. And I think most people seem to accept the fact that
they
should do the davening.
Yep. And yeah, the Magen Avraham, yep. Yeah,
but not everybody agrees.
Yeah, except for Parshas Zohar. No, the Magen Avraham in fact says women are peturot from Kriyas HaTorah because Kriyas HaTorah is Talmud Torah. Now, this would also have an
impact.
Yeah, yeah. But this would also have
one hour.
Yeah.
What is it like?
Yeah, this would also have a lot of relevance. Maybe we'll get into this in Masechta Sofrim itself on the controversial issue in some communities about women having aliyos, without getting into all of that issue. But once again, it's connected to the idea of Talmud Torah and women being exempt from Talmud Torah and Kriyas HaTorah as a fulfillment of public communal Talmud Torah. Yeah. That's correct. But I'll tell you, there's a third way of looking at it. The third way of looking at it is that Kriyas HaTorah might be analogous to a mitzvah like Hakel. Now, a mitzvah like Hakel, right, every 7 years, everybody has to come to hear a public reading of the Torah, including women, and that's not because of tefillah, but we say, Ha'anashim ba'in lilmot. The men come to technically fulfill Talmud Torah. Hanashim ba'in lishmoa. Now lishmoa in that sense means to hear the information that they need to live religiously. So if you look at the weekly Kriyas HaTorah as kind of an expression of Hanashim ba'in lishmoa, then even if you don't tie it to tefillah, there would be an inyan that women are chayavis. The only question then becomes, so why aren't women chayavis on Monday and Thursday? As far as I know, I'm not aware of any minhag that says women are supposed to go to shul Monday and Thursday. Now, if you learn Kriyas HaTorah is only a chayav on its tzibur, it's not a chayav on yachid, then even a man doesn't have to go. But so that might be the answer. But if you say every individual man is supposed to go, then it's not clear to me why we would differentiate between Shabbos morning and Monday and Thursday. Unless you're going to say Moshe Rabbeinu's Takana versus Ezra's Takana, but, you know.
Isn't there also a difference together, whether it's like Matan Torah or Satama Torah. And that has nothing to do with people who stand and people who
sit. That would also be true. If it's a reenactment of Matan Torah, that would be a reason for women to participate.
Yeah. Rishon's
people sit with us. Well, some people, in the yeshiva world, for sure, in the yeshiva world.
Because the Gron points out differently, that only Shavuos is a reenactment of Matan Torah.
Yeah. But some people stand up all the time.
I thought they stood up as a practical reason because they didn't want to have to stand up for that Sefer Dibrot, and then it's never
else. No, that's a separate thing. that would just mean... No, I mean,
you're saying that's not much more important. If they stand up, and it's not more important.
No, what you're saying is a very interesting tshuva of the Rambam. It's actually a tshuva of the Rambam, where the Rambam was opposed... Now, this is not in the Mishnah Torah, but in a separate tshuva. He was opposed to standing up for the Aseret HaDibros, and he brings a very good raya. The Gemara says in Maseches Brachos that originally, they said the Aseret HaDibros every day in the Beis HaMikdash. They said it. But when they wanted to make it a universal custom everywhere, Betzibor, now some people do say it privately afterwards, but to make it part of communal prayer, the Chachamim didn't want to do it because people would think, only the Ten Commandments are the thing that God gave. Like people say today, I believe in the Ten Commandments, although the Fourth Commandment, even that. Okay. So the Rambam argues that Chazal had a fear of overemphasizing the Aseret HaDibros because people would denigrate the rest of the Torah. So the Rambam says, by analogy, I stand up for the Aseret HaDibros, there's a problem. Now Rav Moshe has a tshuva that he defends the minhag, and he says that really, if you just stand up for a few psukim before and a few psukim afterwards, that's going to be. You certainly wouldn't have to stand up the whole year to negate that custom. No, the reason people stand up is because every Kriyas HaTorah is a matan Torah and elect. Okay, so this is what we have. We have the two tiered takana of Kriyas HaTorah, the takana of Moshe and the takana of Ezra. And then one more statement, a short statement, and that is that the way it works, and this we're very familiar with, that is the place where you ended the parsha, Shabbos morning, that's where you start Shabbos Mincha, the next parsha, and you do the same thing on Monday and Thursday and next Shabbos, which means that it's an interesting point that one could ponder, and that is, you don't just go ahead, meaning to say, you might think, well, if Shabbos Mincha I read until Sheni, then Monday I should just read Sheni to Shlishi, and Thursday read Shlishi to Revi, and then Shabbos just do from Revi. The answer is no. You reread the Shabbos Mincha, the Monday, the Thursday, and then Shabbos. Probably this is simply because more people came to shul on Shabbos than any other time. Right, just like today, and therefore we wanted people to hear a whole parsha, and therefore we didn't want to cut away what we read in those prior days. Okay, we'll stop here. Never good chaps. Okay.